sense of jealousy or rivalry. I guess this was part of his personality, something he was born with. I always could believe what he told me. He never minced words, but had no ulterior motives. So, oddly enough, even when his criticism was pretty scathing, I never felt upset. When you finish this painting, before you give it to anyone else, could you let me take a look at it, even just for a minute? He asked, eyes never leaving the painting. Sure, I said. No one commissioned me to do this. I'm just painting it for myself. I don't plan to turn it over to anyone. You want to do your own painting now, right? Seems that way. It's a portrait of sorts, but not a formal portrait. I nodded. You could put it that way, I suppose. You might be discovering a new destination for yourself. I'd like to think so, I said. I saw Yuzu the other day, Masahiko said as he was leaving. Happened to bump into her, and we talked for a half hour or so. I nodded, but said nothing. I had no idea what I should say or how I should react. She seemed fine. We didn't talk about you much. It was like we both wanted to avoid the topic. You get it, that feeling? But at the end, she did ask about you. What you're doing, that kind of thing. I told her you were painting. I don't know what kind of paintings, I said, but I said you're holed up on a mountaintop and painting something. I'm alive, at least, I said. Masahiko seemed to want to say something more about Yuzu, but thought better of it, and clammed up. Yuzu had always liked him, and had apparently gone to him for advice, probably things that had to do with the two of us. Just like I often went to him for advice about paintings. But Masahiko didn't tell me anything. He was that kind of guy. People often sought his advice, but he kept it all inside. Like rain running down a gutter and into a rainwater tank. It doesn't leave there, doesn't spill over the sides. He probably adjusted the amount of water inside as needed. Masahiko didn't seem to ask anyone else for advice about his own troubles. He must have had plenty, as the son of a famous artist who went to art school but wasn't blessed with much talent as an artist. There must have been things he wanted to talk over. I've known him for a long time, but I don't recall ever hearing him complain about anything, even once. That's the type of man he was. Yuzu had a lover, I think, I went ahead and said. During the last part of our marriage, she stopped having sex with me. I should have known something was going on. It was the first time I'd confessed this to anyone. I had kept it all inside until this moment. I see, was all Masahiko said. But you already knew that much, didn't you? He didn't respond. Am I wrong? I asked again. There are things people are better off not knowing. That's all I can say. But whether you know it or not, it ends up the same. Sooner or later, suddenly or not suddenly, with a loud knock or a soft one, that's the only difference. Masahiko sighed. Yeah, you might be right. Whether you knew about it or not, the end result is the same. But still, there are things I can't talk about. I was silent. No matter how things end up, everything has both a good and bad side. I'm sure breaking up with Yuzu was hard on you, and I feel for you, I really do. But because of that, you finally began painting what you want to paint. You've discovered your own style, a kind of silver lining, wouldn't you say? Maybe he was right. If I hadn't split up with Yuzu, I mean, if Yuzu hadn't left me, I'd probably still be painting run-of-the-mill portraits to make a living. But that wasn't a choice I made myself. That's the important point. Try to look on the bright side, Masahiko said as he was leaving. This might sound like dumb advice, but if you're going to walk down a road, it's better to walk down the sunny side, right? And the cup still has 1/16 of the water left. Masahiko laughed. I like your sense of humor. I hadn't said it to be humorous, but didn't comment. Masahiko was silent for a time, and then spoke up. Do you still love Yuzu? I know I have to forget her, but my heart's still clinging to her and won't let go. That's just the way it is. You don't plan to sleep with other women? Even if I did, Yuzu would always come between me and the other woman. That's a problem, he said. He rubbed his forehead with his fingertips. He really did look perplexed. He got in his car and prepared to drive away. Thanks for the whiskey, I said. It was not yet 5 p.m., but the sky was pretty dark. The season when the night gets longer with each passing day. Actually, I wanted to have a drink with you, he said, but I'm driving. Someday soon let's go out and do some serious drinking together. It's been ages. We'll do it soon, I said. There are things people are better off not knowing, Masahiko had said. Maybe so. There are probably things people are better off not hearing as well. But they can't go forever without hearing them. When the time comes, even if they stop their ears up tight, the air will vibrate and invade a person's heart. You can't prevent it. If you don't like it, then the only solution is to live in a vacuum. It was the middle of the night when I woke up. I fumbled for the light next to my bed and looked at the clock. The digital readout showed 1:35. I could hear the bell ringing. That bell. No mistake. I sat up and listened to where the sound was coming from. The bell started ringing again. Someone was ringing it in the middle of the night, and it was much louder, much clearer than ever. Chapter 44. The traits that make a person who they are. Maria didn't speak that morning. She just sat there, the perfect model, in the simple straight-backed chair, and gazed at me as if at some distant landscape. Since my stool was taller than her chair, she was looking up at a slight angle. I made no special attempt to talk to her. There was nothing I had to say, nor did I feel any particular need, so I plied my brush across the canvas in silence. I was painting Maria's portrait, yet I could sense elements of my dead sister Komi and my former wife Yuzu creeping into the work. This wasn't intentional. They worked their way in quite naturally. Perhaps I was searching within Maria for reminders of those two women, so important to me, whom I had lost. I couldn't say if this was healthy or not, but that was the only way I could paint at the time. No, to say at the time is off the mark. When I thought about it, I had operated like this from the very beginning, giving form to what eluded me in reality, inscribing secret signals only I could decipher. Whatever the case, I was able to push Maria's portrait forward with relative ease. Step by step, it moved steadily toward completion. Like a river, it followed the contours of the land, pooling in the hollows until it overflowed the final barrier to stream unobstructed to the sea. I could feel it circulate through my body, like blood. Can I come visit you later? Maria said in a small voice just before we finished our morning's work. The lack of inflection made it sound like an assertion, but it was a clear question. You mean through your secret passageway?
Yes.
I don't mind at all, but around what time?
I don't know yet.
I don't think you should come after dark, I said. You can never tell what's in these mountains at night. All sorts of weird things could be lurking out there. The Commendatore, Longface, the man with the white Subaru Forester, Tomohiko Amada's living spirit. Even the incubus that was my sexual alter ego. Yes, depending on the circumstances, I might turn into one of those sinister creatures that prowled the night. The thought gave me a chill.
I'll try to come before dark, Marius said. I want to talk to you about something, just the two of us.
I'll be waiting. We wrapped up for the day not long after the noon hour chime sounded. Shoko was sitting on the sofa, once again focused on her reading. She appeared to have almost finished the thick paperback. Taking off her glasses, she noted her place with a bookmark and looked up at us.
We made good progress today, I told her. One or two more sessions and we should be done. I'm sorry to be taking so much of your time.
Shoko smiled. It was a beautiful smile.
Not at all, she answered. Maria seems to enjoy sitting for you, and I so look forward to seeing the finished portrait. And this sofa is the perfect place to read. I'm never bored in the slightest. In fact, it's a welcome change of pace for me to come here. I always feel better afterward.
I wanted to ask her how their visit to Menshiki's house had gone the previous Sunday. Had his fine mansion impressed her? What had she thought of him as a person? But asking questions like that would have been a breach of etiquette. I had to wait for her to raise the subject first. Once again, Shoko had dressed for the occasion. It was most definitely not what a regular person would put on to visit a neighbor on a Sunday morning. A perfectly pressed camel hair skirt, a fancy white silk blouse with a big ribbon, and a dark blue-gray jacket with a gold pin adorning the collar. The pin had a jewel embedded in it, which I took to be a real diamond. The whole outfit seemed rather too fashionable to wear behind the wheel of a Toyota Prius, but who was I to say? Toyota's director of marketing would likely have a very different opinion. Maria was dressed as usual, the same old varsity jacket, her hole-studded jeans, and a pair of white sneakers even dirtier than the ones she usually wore. The backs of these were stomped flat. When they were heading out the door, Maria looked back and gave me a wink, a secret sign that said, "See you later." I flashed a quick smile in response. When Shoko and Maria had gone, I went to the living room, lay down on the sofa, and slept. I had no appetite, so I skipped lunch. It was a brief nap, about 30 minutes, deep and dreamless. I was grateful for that. It was more than a little scary to think what I might do in my dreams, and even scarier to think what I might become. My mood that Sunday afternoon was as unfocused as the weather. It was a quiet, slightly overcast day with no wind to speak of. I read a little, listened to a little music, cooked a little, but nothing helped me work out my feelings. It promised to be one of those afternoons where nothing gets resolved. Giving up, I ran a hot bath, got in, and soaked for a long time. I tried to remember the names of the characters in Dostoevsky's The Possessed. I was able to come up with 7, including Kirillov. For some reason, since my high school days, I've had a knack for memorizing lengthy Russian names. Maybe now was a good opportunity to go back and reread The Possessed. I was free, with time on my hands and nothing that had to be done. The perfect conditions for reading long Russian classics. I thought about Yuzu some more. Her belly would probably be showing after 7 months. I pictured how that would look. What would she be doing now? What would she be thinking? Was she happy? Of course, I had no way to know any of those things. Perhaps it was as Masahiko had said. Perhaps, like a 19th-century Russian intellectual, I should do something out-and-out crazy just to prove I was a free man. But what? Something like spend an hour shut up at the bottom of a pitch-black pit? That was what Menshiki had done. True, his actions might not fit the category out-and-out crazy, but they were definitely beyond the pale, to put it mildly. It was after 4 when Maria showed up. The doorbell rang, I opened the door, and there she was. She slipped through the half-open door like a wisp of cloud and looked around warily.
No one's here, Nobody's here, that's true, I said.
Someone was here yesterday.
That was a question. Yes, a friend of mine stayed over, I said.
A man.
Yes, a man, a male friend. But how did you know?
There was an old car I'd never seen before parked in front of your house. It looked like a black box.
That would be Masahiko's ancient Volvo station wagon, what he called his Swedish lunchbox, convenient for hauling reindeer carcasses.
So you came yesterday?
Maria nodded. It appeared that she was using her passageway to come and check on the house whenever she had time. She'd probably been doing this since long before my arrival. After all, it was her playground, or hunting ground might be more accurate. I was just someone who had chanced to move in which case, could she have come face to face with Tomohiko Amada at some point? I had to ask her about that sometime. I led her into the living room. We sat down together, she on the sofa, me in the armchair. I offered her something to drink, but she said no.
The guy who stayed over is a friend from my college days, I said.
A good friend?
I think so, I said. In fact, he may be the only person I can call a true friend.
Such a good friend that he could introduce his colleague to my wife and keep me in the dark when they started sleeping together, a situation that had led to my just concluded divorce, without casting a cloud over our relationship. To call us friends would hardly be stretching the truth.
Do you have any good friends? I asked her.
Maria didn't answer. In fact, she didn't bat an eye, just acted as if she hadn't heard what I'd said. I guessed it was something I shouldn't have asked.
Mr. Manshiki isn't a good friend of yours, she said.
I knew it was a question, though her intonation was flat.
Do you mean Mr. Manshiki isn't a good friend of yours? Was what she meant.
As I've told you, I said, I haven't known Mr. Manshiki long enough to call him a real friend. I started talking with him after I moved here, and that was only 6 months ago. It takes longer than that for people to become close. Still, he strikes me as a very interesting person.
Interesting?
How can I explain? His disposition strikes me as a little different than the average guy. Maybe more than a little, actually. He's not an easy person to figure out.
Disposition.
Personality. The traits that make a person who they are.
Maria stared at me for a while, as if selecting the exact words she ought to use.
He can see my home from his deck. It's right across the valley.
It took me a moment to respond to that.
Yes, you're right. That's the lay of the land. But he can see my house just as clearly, not yours alone.
Still, I think that man is spying on us.
What do you mean, spying on you?
He's got something like a pair of big binoculars on the terrace, though he hides them with a cover. They're on a kind of tripod. He can see us really clearly if he uses those.
So the girl found him out, I thought. Watchful, observant. Eyes that missed nothing of importance.
So you think that Mr. Manshiki has been observing you through those binoculars?
Maria gave a terse nod. I took a deep breath, then let it out.
Still, that's just a guess on your part, right? They don't necessarily mean he's peeking into your house. He could be observing the moon and stars.
Maria's gaze didn't waver.
I've had this feeling like I'm being watched, she said, for a while. But I didn't know who was watching me or from where. But now I know. It's that person for sure.
I took another long, slow breath. Maria's supposition was on the money. Manshiki was watching her through his high-powered military binoculars on a nightly basis. Yet, to my knowledge, and this was not to defend Manshiki, his motives for being a peeping Tom were far from nefarious. He just wanted to see the girl. this beautiful 13-year-old girl who might be his biological daughter. For that reason, and that reason alone, he had purchased the mansion on the other side of the valley, wresting it from the family living there and booting them out. Yet I couldn't reveal that to Maria.
"Let's say you're right," I said. "But then what's his motive? Why is he so fixated on your home?"
"I don't know. Maybe he has a crush on my aunt."
"Has a crush on your aunt?"
She gave a brief shrug of her shoulders. Maria couldn't imagine she was the target. She hadn't yet reached the stage where she could see herself as an object of male desire. I found it strange, yet I didn't dare call her version of events into question. If that was how she read the situation, better perhaps to let it ride.
"I think Mr. Manshiki is hiding something," Maria said.
"What, for example?"
"My aunt is seeing Mr. Manshiki," she said, not answering my question. "They met twice this week."
Her tone suggested that she was passing on highly sensitive state secrets. "On dates?"
"I think she went to his house."
"Alone?"
"She left a little after noon and didn't return until late."
"But you can't be sure she went to Mr. Manshiki's, can you?"
"I can tell," she said.
"How can you tell?"
"My aunt doesn't leave the house that much," she said. "Sure, she'll volunteer at the library or go shopping, but then she doesn't take a long shower or paint her nails or put on perfume and her fanciest underwear."
"You really have sharp eyes, don't you?" I said, impressed. "You see everything. But are you sure the man she's meeting is Mr. Manshiki? Couldn't it be someone else?"
Maria narrowed her eyes at me. She gave a small shake of her head, as in, "Do you think I'm that stupid?" After all, under the circumstances, it was unlikely to be anyone but Manshiki. And Maria was anything but stupid.
"So your aunt spends quite a bit of time at Mr. Manshiki's house, just the two of them together?"
Maria nodded.
"And the two of them, how should I put this, are engaged in what we might call a very intimate relationship?"
She nodded again.
"Yes, a very intimate relationship," she said, her cheeks turning a faint pink.
"But you're in school all day, not at home. So how can you know these things?"
"I can tell. I can tell that much from a woman's face."
But I couldn't tell. Yuzu had carried on an extended affair while we were living together, and I was clueless. Looking back, I should have been able to figure out that much. How could a 13-year-old girl pick up on something I couldn't that quickly?
"So things really moved fast between those two, didn't they?" I said.
"My aunt's no dummy. There's nothing wrong with her head, but her heart has a weak spot. And Mr. Manshiki is stronger than normal people, a lot stronger. She's no match for him."
She's probably right, I thought. Manshiki did have some special power. Once he made his move, it would be almost impossible for an average person to resist. Myself included. I doubted he would find it difficult to make a woman his if that was his goal.
"So you're worried about your aunt, right? That Mr. Manshiki is using her for some reason?"
Maria swept her hair back with her hand, exposing her ear. It was small and white, and its shape was lovely. She nodded.
"But it's not that easy to stop a relationship of this sort once it's gotten started," I said.
"Not that easy at all," I said to myself. It would move forward, crushing everything in its path, like the Hindu's great wheel of karma. There could be no turning back.
"That's why I had to talk to you," Maria said.
Then she looked me square in the eye. When it began to get dark, I took my flashlight and walked Maria almost as far as her passageway. She said she had to be home by dinner. They usually ate around 7. She had come to ask me for advice, yet I hadn't been able to offer anything useful. All I could tell her was to wait and see how things developed. I knew Manshiki and Shoko might be having sex, but they were two unmarried and consenting adults. What was I supposed to do? Sure, I had some background information, but I couldn't reveal it, not to Maria and not to her aunt. That meant that I couldn't give useful advice to anyone. I was like a boxer trying to fight with his best arm tied behind his back. Maria and I walked side by side through the woods, hardly exchanging a word. We had gone part way along the path when she reached down and took my hand. Her hand was small, but its grip was unexpectedly firm. I was surprised at first, but then I had often walked this way with my sister, so it didn't put me off. Instead, it felt normal, a kind of return to my youth. Maria's hand was very smooth to the touch, warm but not at all sweaty. She must have been thinking about something, for her hand squeezed mine and relaxed, squeezed and relaxed, depending, I guess, on what she was thinking. My sister had done the same thing back in the old days. When we reached the shrine, she let go of my hand and, without a word, circled around to the back. I followed her. The pampas grass still bore the tread marks of the backhoe. Within lay the silent pit. Its cover was made of sturdy boards, weighted down by a row of stones. I shone my flashlight on them to confirm that they hadn't been moved. They hadn't. "Is it okay if I look in?" Maria asked me. "Just look. Just look," Maria said. I set some of the stones to the side and removed one of the boards. Maria knelt and peered through the opening. I trained the flashlight on the floor of the pit. Of course, nobody was there, only a metal ladder leaning against the wall. If one so chose, one could use it to climb down and then back up again. It would be next to impossible to get out without the ladder, although the pit was less than 9 feet deep. The walls were just too smooth and slick to be scaled. Holding her hair back with one hand, Maria stared inside the pit for a long time, intently, as if searching for something in the dark. I had no idea what was down there to capture her attention. "Who built this?" she asked, looking up at last. "I don't know. At first I thought it might be a well, but now I'm not so sure. I mean, who would dig a well in such an out-of-the-way place? Anyway, it looks very old, and it's very well put together. It must have taken a long time to build." Maria looked at me steadily without saying anything. "This area has been your playground for quite a while, hasn't it?" I said. She nodded. "But you didn't know this pit was behind the shrine until recently." She shook her head. No, she hadn't known.
"You found it and opened it, didn't you?" she asked.
"That's right. I may have been the one who discovered it. I didn't know it was a pit, but I figured something had to be under that pile of rocks. The person who arranged for the rocks to be moved and the pit to be opened, though, was Mr. Manshiki." I wanted to let her in on this much, at least. It was better to be honest. A bird cried in the trees. It was a sharp, piercing call, as if to warn its fellow creatures. I looked up, but couldn't catch sight of it. All I could see were the layered branches of the leafless trees, and beyond those the evening sky of approaching winter, flat, expressionless, and gray. Maria winced slightly, but she didn't respond. "It's hard to explain," I said. I felt as if the pit was demanding that someone open it, and that I had been bidden to perform that task.
"Bidden?"
"Invited. Called upon to." She looked up at me.
"It wanted you to open it?"
"Yes."
"This pit asked you to open it?"
"It could have been anyone, perhaps. Maybe I just happened to be around."
"But it was Mr. Manshiki who actually did it."
"Yes, I brought him here. I couldn't have uncovered it without him. The rocks were too heavy to move by hand, and I didn't have the cash to bring in heavy equipment. It was a fortunate coincidence.
Maybe you shouldn't have done it, she said after a moment's thought. I think I told you that before.
So you think I should have left it as it was? Maria didn't answer immediately. She stood up and brushed the dirt off the knees of her jeans. Not once, but several times. She and I replaced the board and the stones that held it down. Once again, I committed their location to memory.
Yes, I think so, she said at last, lightly rubbing her palms against each other.
I think this place may have had some kind of religious background. There might be legends or stories connected to it. Maria shook her head. She didn't know of any.
Maybe my father knows something.
The whole area had been owned by her father's family since before the Meiji period. The adjoining mountain was also in their hands. He might have a good idea of what the pit and shrine meant.
Could you ask him?
Maria winced slightly.
I'll try, she said in a small voice. She hesitated. If I have a chance.
It would be a big help if we knew who built it, when, and for what purpose.
Maybe they shut up something inside and put heavy stones on top to make sure it didn't get out, she offered.
So you think maybe they heaped on the stones to prevent whatever it was from escaping, and then built the little shrine to ward off its curse?
Maybe.
And then we went and pried it open anyway. Maria gave a small shrug. I accompanied her to where the woods ended. She'd go on from there by herself, she said. The darkness was no problem, she knew the way. She wanted no one to see the passage that led to her home. It was a shortcut that she alone should know. So I turned back, leaving her there. Only a glimmer of light remained in the sky. The cold blackness was descending. The same bird made the same piercing call when I passed before the shrine. This time, though, I didn't look up. I headed straight home, leaving the shrine behind. As I prepared dinner, I sipped a glass of Chivas Regal and water. There was only enough left in the bottle for one more drink. The night was deathly silent, as if the clouds were absorbing every living sound.
You shouldn't have opened the pit.
Perhaps Maria was right. I should have steered clear of the pit. It seemed that everything I did these days was off the mark. I imagined Menshiki making love to Shoko. The two of them naked, entwined on a big bed in a room somewhere in that sprawling white mansion. That event was taking place in another world, of course, one that bore no connection to me. Yet the thought of the two of them together left me bereft, as if I were standing in a station watching a long, empty train pass by. Finally, I fell asleep, and my Sunday ended. A deep, dreamless sleep, undisturbed by anyone.
Chapter 45. Something is about to happen. Of the two paintings I was working on, the pit in the woods was the one I knocked off first. It was Friday afternoon when I finished it. Paintings are strange things. As they near the end, they acquire their own will, their own viewpoint, even their own powers of speech. They tell the artist when they are done. At least, that's the way it works for me. A spectator to the process, if one is present, can't tell the difference between a painting in process and a completed painting, for the line is virtually invisible to the naked eye. But the artist knows. He or she can hear the painting say, "Hands off, I'm done." The artist has only to heed that voice. So it was with the pit in the woods. At a certain point, it announced itself finished and refused my brush.
like a sexually satisfied woman. I took the canvas from the easel and leaned it against the wall. Then I sat down on the floor and regarded it at length. My painting of a half-covered hole in the ground. I couldn't pin down my motive for painting it, or its meaning. It had just grabbed me. I couldn't come up with anything beyond that. These things happen. When something strikes me in that way, a landscape, an object, a person, I pick up my brush and I'm off to the races. No meaning, no motive. I just go where my gut tells me, pure and simple. But wait, I thought. This time was different. This wasn't mere impulse. Something had demanded that I paint this painting, urgently. That was why I had finished it so quickly. Whatever it was, that demand had fired me up, sent me to my easel, and propelled me forward, like a hand on my back. Or maybe the pit was the agent, pushing me to draw its portrait, leaving me to guess its motive. In the same way that Minshiki, likely in pursuit of some larger plan, had enlisted me to paint his portrait. Judged in a fair and objective way, the painting wasn't bad. I couldn't tell whether it could be called a work of art or not. Not to make excuses, but I hadn't begun with that goal in mind. From the standpoint of pure technique, though, it was a success. The composition was flawless, and I had captured both the light streaming through the trees and the colors of the fallen leaves. It was realistic right down to its tiniest detail, yet, nevertheless, a mysterious, symbolic aura hovered over it. As I sat there staring at the finished work, a feeling came over me, what might be called a premonition of impending movement. On the surface, at least, it was just as its title said, a landscape painting of the pit in the woods. It was so accurate, in fact, that reproduction might be closer to the truth. As someone who had been developing his craft, however imperfectly, for so long, I had the artistic skill to reproduce an exact likeness of the scene on canvas. I had not painted the scene so much as I had documented it. Nevertheless, that premonition was there. Something was about to take place within that landscape. The painting was telling me that. Then I realized what I had been trying to get across, or what that something had been trying to get me to paint, was precisely that premonition, those signs. Sitting there on the floor, I straightened my back and looked at the painting anew. What was about to happen? Was someone or something about to come crawling out from the darkness that lay beneath the half-open cover? Or, conversely, was someone about to climb down into the hole? Though I looked long and hard, I couldn't guess what would take place. I only knew some sort of movement was about to occur. The strength of my premonition left no doubt. Why did the pit so badly want me to paint it? To try to tell me something? To warn me? It was a game of riddles. So many riddles and not a single answer. I wanted to show the painting to Maria and hear what she had to say. Maybe she could see what I couldn't. Friday was the day I taught drawing near Odawara Station. Maria was one of the students, so she would be there. Perhaps I could have a word with her afterward. I hopped in my car and headed to town. There was still plenty of time when I arrived, so I parked and went to get my customary cup of coffee. No gleaming, functional Starbucks for me. My coffee shop was untouched by time. A back-alley spot run by a man on the cusp of old age who served a jet-black, muddy brew in a cup that weighed a ton. Jazz from a former era played on the ancient speakers, Billie Holiday, Clifford Brown, and other classics. As I still had time to spare when I finished my coffee, I wandered down the shopping street. I was low on coffee filters, so I bought a pack. I found a used record store and browsed through their old LPs. I realized I hadn't listened to anything other than classical music for a very long time. Tomohiko Amada's shelves contained no other kinds of records. If I listened to the radio, it was only to catch the news and weather on the AM dial. My location meant almost no FM reception. I had left my records and CDs, not that there were a lot of them, in the Hiro apartment. It would have been painful to sort out which books and records belonged to Yuzu and which to me. Impossible, really. Who did Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline belong to? How about the Doors album with Alabama Song on it? What difference did it make? Who had shelled out the money? We'd shared the same music for a period of time, lived our life together listening to it. Even if we had been able to divide the records, we could never have separated the memories attached to them. I had to leave them all behind. I looked for Nashville Skyline and the first album by the Doors, but couldn't find either. They may have been available on CD, but I wanted to hear them on an old-style phonograph. There was no CD player in Tomohiko Amada's house anyway, and no cassette deck. Just a couple of record players. Tomohiko Amada likely had no interest in new technology. He'd probably never come within 6 feet of a microwave oven. In the end, I bought two records, Bruce Springsteen's The River and a collection of duets by Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway. Both were old favorites of mine. At some point in my life, I had given up on new music. Instead, I listened to the old stuff over and over again. Books were the same. I reread books from my past, often more than once, but ignored books that had just come out. Somewhere along the way, time seemed to have come to a screeching halt. Perhaps time really had stopped. Then again, maybe it kept nudging forward despite the fact that evolution, or anything resembling it, had ended. Like a restaurant approaching closing time that has stopped taking orders. And I was the only one who hadn't figured it out. The shop assistant put the two records in a bag and I paid. Then I went to a nearby liquor store to buy some whiskey. I wasn't sure what to get, but finally settled on Chivas Regal. It was a little more expensive, but would be a big hit with Masahiko the next time he stopped by. My starting time for class was approaching, so I stashed the records, coffee filters, and whiskey in my car and entered the building where classes were held. The kids were first, starting at 5 o'clock. Mario was part of that group, but I couldn't spot her. This was a first. She was passionate about the class, had never skipped it before, as far as I knew. Her absence unsettled me. I found it somehow alarming, even threatening. Was she all right? Was she ill, or had something unexpected happened to her? Nevertheless, I carried on as though nothing was wrong, assigning simple exercises, offering comments on each child's drawing, giving advice. When class ended, the children went home and the adult class began. It, too, passed without incident. I exchanged good-natured pleasantries with the people there, hardly my strong point, but I can do it when required. After that, I had a brief meeting with the workshop organizer about future plans. He had no idea why Maria was absent. There had been no word from her family. After work, I went to a nearby noodle shop and ate a hot bowl of tempura soba. This, too, was my weekly habit. Always the same shop and always tempura soba. One of life's little pleasures. Then I drove back to my house on the mountain. It was almost 9 when I arrived. I couldn't tell if anyone had tried to contact me while I was gone, for there was no answering machine, such a clever device probably numbered among Tomohiko Amada's bête noire. I gave the simple old-fashioned telephone a long look, but it didn't speak. It just sat there, in black silence. I had a long soak in a hot bath, then I poured what was left of the original bottle of Chivas Regal into a glass, added 2 ice cubes from the fridge, and took the drink to the living room, where I sipped it while listening to one of the records I had just bought. At first, it seemed somehow inappropriate to be playing anything other than classical in my mountaintop domicile. The air in the room had been conditioned to that type of music for a very long time. Still, I was playing my music, so that now, song by song, a familiarity overcame the feeling of inappropriateness. As I listened, I could feel my body start to relax. I must have been tense without being aware of it. The A-side of the Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway record had ended, and the first song on the B-side, For All We Know, a really cool performance, had just begun when the phone rang. The clock said 10:30. Who on earth would be calling me so late? I didn't want to answer. Yet the ring sounded urgent. I put down my glass, rose from the sofa, lifted the needle off the record, and picked up the phone. Hello? It was Shoko Akikawa. I greeted her. I'm so terribly sorry to be phoning this late, she said. I had never heard her sound so anxious. But I needed to ask you something. Maria didn't show up at art class today, did she? No, I replied. She didn't. The question was a strange one. Normally, Maria came straight from school, the public junior high in the area, in her uniform. When class ended, her aunt picked her up in the car, and the two went home together. That pattern never varied. I haven't seen Maria anywhere, Shoko said. Haven't seen her? She's missing. Since what time? I asked. Since this morning when she left for school. I offered to drive her to the station, but she said she'd walk. She likes walking, much more than riding in the car. So I give her a lift when she's running late, but otherwise she walks down the hill to the bus stop and takes the bus to the station. This morning she left the house at 7:30 as usual. Shoko said all this in a single breath, then stopped. I could hear her trying to control her breathing. I used the pause to put what she had just told me into some kind of order. Today is Friday, Shoko continued. When school lets out on Friday, she goes directly to art class, and then I pick her up afterward. But today, Maria said she'd take the bus home instead, so I didn't go. When she says something like that, it's pointless to argue, but she still gets back by 7 or 7:30. Then she has dinner, but tonight it turned to 8, and then 8:30, and she still hadn't returned. So I called the center and asked whether she had come to class or not. They checked and said she hadn't shown up. That's when I got really worried. Now it's 10:30, and she's still not back. I've heard nothing. That's why I'm calling you. I thought perhaps you might know something. I haven't a clue where she is, I said. I was rather surprised when I showed up for class and Maria wasn't there. She's never skipped before. Shoko gave a deep sigh. My brother's not back yet. I don't know when to expect him. He hasn't contacted me. I'm not sure if he'll return tonight or not. I'm here all alone and I don't know what to do. She was wearing her school uniform when she left this morning, correct? Yes, she left in her uniform with a bag over her shoulder, the same as always. A blazer and skirt. I don't know if she ever made it to school, though. It's late, so there's no way to check. But I'm quite sure she got there. The school contacts us if there's an unexplained absence. She was carrying enough money for a single day's expenses, no more. I make her take a cell phone just in case, but it's been shut off all day. She doesn't like cell phones. She'll use hers to call me, but she usually keeps it off the rest of the time. I've warned her about that over and over, begged her not to turn it off, explained that we may need to reach her if something important comes up, but she doesn't. Has this ever happened before? Her coming home late? This is the first time, really. Maria is very dependable. She has no close friends she hangs out with, and once she's agreed to do something, she follows through, even though she doesn't like school all that much. She won a prize for perfect attendance in elementary school. She always comes straight home after school. She never loiters along the way. Maria's aunt was clearly in the dark about her nighttime forays. Was there anything she said or did this morning that was out of the ordinary?
No, nothing. It was a regular morning, the same as always. She drinks a glass of warm milk, eats a slice of toast, and heads out the door. Every day is identical. I made her breakfast today as I usually do. She didn't say a great deal, but that's normal. She can talk a blue streak once she gets started, but most of the time you can't get much out of her.
I was beginning to worry. It was almost 11 at night, and it was pitch dark outside. The moon was hiding behind the clouds. What on earth had happened to Maria Akikawa?
I'll wait one more hour. If Maria still hasn't contacted me by then, I'll call the police, Shoko said.
That's a good idea, I said. And let me know if there's anything I can do. Any time is all right. Please don't hesitate, no matter how late it is.
Shoko thanked me and hung up. I drained what was left of the whiskey and washed the glass in the sink. After that, I went to the studio. I turned on all the lights and stood there in the bright room, taking another lingering look at my unfinished portrait of Maria Akikawa on the easel. It was close to done, only a little work remained. It showed a version of what a quiet 13-year-old girl would ideally look like. Yet there were other elements too, aspects of her that could not be seen that made her who she was. What I was attempting in all my painting, though not, of course, in the portraits I did on commission, was to try to capture those things which lay outside my field of vision and communicate their message in a different form. Maria was, in that sense, a most fascinating subject. There was just so much that was hidden, like a trompe l'oeil, and now, as of this morning, she herself had disappeared, as if swallowed by that very trompe l'oeil. I turned to look again at the pit in the woods leaning against the wall. I had just completed it that afternoon. I could feel that painting calling out to me too, though in another way, and from a different direction than a portrait of Maria Akikawa. Something is about to happen. I felt this again as I looked at the landscape. Until that afternoon, it had been a premonition of sorts, but now it was encroaching on reality. The movement was already underway. Maria's disappearance and the pit in the woods were linked in some way. I could sense it. By finishing the painting, I had set the gears in motion, and Maria's vanishing act was the likely result. Yet I could tell Shoko none of this. All that would do was confuse her even more. I went back to the kitchen and rinsed the whiskey taste from my mouth with several glasses of water. When that was done, I picked up the phone and called Menshiki. I called 3 times before he picked up. I detected a slight edge to his voice, as if he were waiting for an important call. That it was me on the line seemed to surprise him. It only took a second, though, for the edge to disappear and the voice to turn cool and collected, as always. I'm very sorry to call so late, I said.
Not at all. I stay up late and I've got plenty of time. I'm always happy to hear your voice.
Skipping the normal pleasantries, I gave him a brief report of Maria's disappearance. The girl had left home for school in the morning, but hadn't returned. Nor had she shown up at my painting class. The news seemed to throw Menshiki for a loop. He took a moment to reply.
And you have no idea where she might have gone, right?
He asked me.
None at all, I replied. It came out of left field. How about you?
I have no idea either, of course. She barely says a word to me.
There was no anger or regret in his voice. He was simply relating the way she treated him. That's just how she is. She's like that with everybody, I said. But Shoko is at her wit's end. Maria's father isn't home either, so she's all alone and unsure what to do. Menshiki paused again. It was rare to see him at a loss for words. In fact, I had never witnessed it before.
Is there anything I can do? He said at last.
I know it's sudden, I said. But is there any chance you could drop by now?
To your home?
Yes. There's something in this connection that I need to talk to you about.
Menshiki took a moment to respond. All right, he said. I'll leave right away.
Are you sure you don't have to take care of a matter there first?
It's not big enough to call a matter. It's just a trivial thing, he said.
He cleared his throat. He seemed to be checking his watch.
I can be there in about 15 minutes.
When the phone call ended, I got ready to go out. I laid out a sweater and my leather jacket and placed the big flashlight within easy reach. Then I sat on the sofa and waited for the purr of Menshiki's Jaguar rolling up the hill.
Chapter 46. People are powerless before a sturdy, towering wall.
Menshiki arrived at 11:20.
The moment I heard his Jaguar, I slipped on my leather jacket and headed out the door. He stepped from the car wearing a padded dark blue windbreaker, narrow-cut black jeans, and leather sneakers. A light scarf was draped around his neck. His mane of white hair glowed in the dark.
If it's okay, I'd like you to come with me to check out the pit in the woods, I said.
Of course, Menshiki said. Do you think it's connected to Maria's disappearance?
I'm not sure, but I've had a premonition for a while that something bad was going to happen. Something connected to that pit.
Menshiki asked no more questions after that.
Fine, he said. Let's go take a look.
He opened the trunk of his Jaguar and pulled out what looked like a lantern. Then he closed the trunk and set off with me toward the woods. Neither moon nor stars were out, so it was very dark. There was no wind.
Sorry to ask you to venture out so late, I said, but it seemed safer to have you come along. If something went wrong, I might not be able to handle it alone.
He patted my arm, as though to encourage me.
It's no trouble at all. I'm happy to do what I can.
We picked our way through the trees, shining the flashlight and lantern on our feet to avoid tripping over the roots. The only sound was the crunch of dry leaves underfoot. Otherwise, it was dead silent. I sensed the animals of the woods silently watching us from their hiding places. The dark depths of midnight give rise to illusions like that. Had someone seen us, they might have mistaken us for a pair of grave robbers on their way to ransack a tomb.
There's just one thing I'd like to ask, Menshiki said.
What's that?
Why do you think Maria's disappearance and the pit might be connected?
I explained that she and I had visited the pit together not long before, that she had already known about its existence, that the whole area was her playground, that nothing happened here without her knowledge. Then I told him what she had said. You should have left the place as it was. You should never have opened it up.
When she stood in front of the pit, she seemed to have experienced something, I said.
A special feeling. I guess you could call it spiritual.
And she was drawn to it?
Yes, she was leery, but at the same time something about the pit was drawing her in. That's why I worry it might have played a role, that she might be down there unable to get out.
Menshiki thought for a moment.
Did you tell her aunt this? He asked. Does Shoko know?
No, I haven't said anything yet. If I mentioned the pit to her, I'd have to go back to the beginning, to how we opened it and why you were involved. It would turn into a very long story, and I doubt I could explain myself very well.
Yes, it would cause her a lot of needless worry.
It would be even more awkward if the police got involved, if they grew interested in the pit.
Menshiki looked at me.
Are they investigating already?
She hadn't contacted them yet when I talked to her, but she could have put in a search request by now. After all, it's getting pretty late.
Menshiki nodded several times.
Yes, it's only natural. It's almost midnight and a 13-year-old girl hasn't come home. No one knows where she's gone.
What can her family do but call the cops?
I could tell from his tone that Manshiki wasn't too thrilled that the police would be entering the picture.